Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello everyone and welcome to Archaeoanimals, the podcast which sometimes talks about animal bones and more often than not talks about a lot of other things. Here on the show with you as always is me, Simona Falanga, and...
me, Alex Fitzpatrick.
Who has had dinner today, I've heard.
It's okay. We can't keep doing this because at this point, I've matured enough to start having dinner before we record podcasts. It's a new age of Alex, okay?
You see, like, that's a telltale sign that the podcast has gone on for too long because you see you're sort of developing as people. You see all this character development going on.
It's an arc. Yeah, we all have arcs. One day you'll stop talking about Romans. We're not there yet. Need a couple more years, probably.
Well, maybe this episode it won't happen.
I don't know. I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know what? I bet she'll figure out a way. I believe in you. I believe in your ability to do this. It's a gorgeous ability you have to kind of just bring up Romans whenever.
I like long walks on the beach and talking about the Romans.
Yeah.
Which I don't even like that much. That is the ultimate joke of it all.
It's a gift. It's a curse, you know. But today we are technically not talking about the Romans. We are starting not really a mini series, but it's a two-parter. We decided we're going to talk a bit about the zooarchaeology of myths and legends. And why don't we start off this first part of this two-parter by talking about the not Romans. I'm talking about Norse mythology.
So yeah, definitely not Romans. But yeah, I think the idea for these episodes, because we've got two in mind at the minute, but of course, you know, this is only the smallest slice of mythology and pretty much, again, mostly looking at Europe. Mm-hmm. But if any of you have any suggestions, please tweet at us at Archaeoanimals on any sort of myths and legends and mythologies you'd like us to discuss and might be able to put in together a few more parts. It's an interactive mini-series.
Yeah, like all of our episodes are basically interactive. I'm sure most people spend our episodes yelling at us for pronouncing something wrong, which will probably happen in this episode and in the next episode. Maybe not that much in the next episode.
And all the episodes to come.
Yeah, I mean, po' buddies nerfed, as they say. But I kind of figured these are two of the most known in the general population mythical pantheon, so I as well start with them. So Norse mythology, especially, let's be real, Marvel, I feel like, has done loads for getting people to at least know very basic tenets of Norse mythology. But of course, it's in a lot of video games. There seems to have been like a good stretch of just like with Skyrim and then kind of the next 10 years, Norse themed games seem to have been really popular.
Games and series, I think there's been a proper sort of resurgence because I guess Skyrim, what was that, 2012?
2011.
11, wow. And I guess then the History Channel series of Vikings wasn't too long after that. So, of course, that probably did something to it. And then I think all sorts of series and films and video games, of course, the latest being Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which we did cover on a separate episode, if you'd like to scroll back. Well, I guess I can self-promote on my podcast. Yes.
Yeah. It's fine. It's our podcast. We're allowed to do whatever. But yeah. And I mean, there's also the most recent God of War games, including the Ragnarok, which is coming out soon. There's a lot of Norse mythology in the air.
I was going to mention that, the God of War, and then it just went in my head and then out again. But yeah, new one coming out soon. So that should be exciting. Well, I'm excited.
Yeah, no, but it's just very interesting that there's this, not even a resurgence, there's always been a general interest in Norse mythology, for better or worse, because obviously there are some bad faith actors who love to use Norse mythology, which I don't really want to spend too much of this episode talking about.
We're good.
But yeah, one thing I do like about us kind of covering the zoo archaeology of Norse mythology is that it's a bit of a breath of fresh air from a lot of the prehistoric talk we tend to do, because we have written texts to help us learn about Norse mythology, which technically they are written texts based on oral traditions. But hey, am I going to say no to a written text? Absolutely not.
It's a good jumping point. I think a lot of the Norse mythology information that we have now come from like the prose Edda, the poetic Edda. But of course, you know, as far as Norse mythology is concerned, but as well as sort of the Viking sagas, if you will, you'll have to bear in mind, of course, these mainly being oral traditions, they weren't written down until much, much later. I mean, some of these texts we're referring to, I think they're like 14th century. So it's way past the sort of what is known as the Viking Age. So likely a lot of it would have changed over time. And of course, we need to bear in mind that by the time these texts was written, these populations would have been Christianized.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, sort of stories were at times changed to suit the new faith of the area. But it's better than nothing.
I don't think we really have as much evidence for seeing that change in the Norse mythology as much as when we get to our next part of this little two-parter, which just stay tuned for that. I don't want to spoil anything, but the pantheon we're covering the next episode, I think you see a much more distinctive change as time goes on. But the written text that we have, you got to take it while you find it. And to be honest, I think it's consistent enough that we can easily just jump on that and use that as part of looking at the archaeology. And again, you know, I think Norse mythology is pretty well known, at least the general aspects of it, especially since a lot of the gods and goddesses are now Marvel characters, which I kind of want to read the copyright kind of stuff on that. That's very strange to me because they really don't. I don't know how much you know about the Marvel, you know, Midgardians, and I mean Asgardians, sorry.
I know what they look like, so I think I can picture in my head the actors playing Thor and Loki respectively, and that's about where my Marvel knowledge ends.
Well, I think the wildest thing is they really just don't change anything. To be honest, I don't have as much knowledge about the comics version of the Marvel characters, but they literally use the terminology that you use in the actual Norse mythology. Obviously, the names haven't changed, and they use things like Midgard and Asgard. It's really wild to think about. But I guess it also is kind of like the natural extension of gods and goddesses. Is obviously, yeah, they're basically superheroes. So
definitely one way to look at them.
But yeah, so just to kind of give a brief rundown, you have, it is a pantheon of gods. You have Odin, who is basically kind of the ruler of the gods. I think that's a bit flattening of what his actual position is, but for all intents and purposes, he kind of is. And he's also a bit of a warrior god, as many of them are, but also, interestingly enough, I think for a lot of people who don't know that much about Norse mythology, he's kind of the god of wisdom, of poetry, a lot of knowledge, things like that, which I've always really found interesting.
Yeah, and also I guess, like, for the head of a pantheon, he's a bit of a trickster himself.
Yeah, and I love that. So, like, full disclosure, I'm a many things. I'm also Norwegian. My nana immigrated from Norway to the States. So I grew up with a lot of not only learning about Norwegian culture, but also Norse mythology and kind of speaking Norwegian. So like my dog was named Thor. So I grew up with like a huge fascination, and it explains why I kind of ended up in archaeology, to be honest, because I originally did Viking Age archaeology.
Well, you've actually, in a way, at one point you've studied both of these mythologies that we'll be covering.
Boo. No, to be fair, that was basically my undergrad. But yeah, let's not spoil something that, you know, it's not really going to be that exciting, but whatever. It's fine. anyway, let's keep running them down. Thor, God of Thunder, aka my Alaskan Husky, RIP, I miss you, Thor, every day. Loki, everyone's favorite trickster god and also very famous on Disney Plus. I will say Loki was actually quite good. I actually really like that series. I like weird stuff as a, you know, not pre-opposed to Marvel as a lot of other people. I like it when they do weird stuff, and I like Owen Wilson. He's kind of turned into almost a silver fox. Good for him. Anyway.
Yes. I've got no idea what you're talking about anyway. So
it's fine.
There's a series. Okay.
Oh, it's a mini series. Very good, actually. Anyway, Freya, goddess of love and beauty, also cats, kind of. I believe, yeah, Freya's the one that's got...
Yeah, the chariot of cats, yeah.
Yeah, ideal life.
God, I wish that were me.
Oh, God, I really wish that were me. Heimdall is a sort of... He's not really a guardian god, but I feel like that's the best way to kind of describe him. He sees all, played by Idris Elba in the Marvel series. Again, Stone Cold Fox, we stan. Yeah, those are kind of, there's loads of other gods, but I think those are kind of like the main ones that most people are familiar with.
I guess it'd be Balder as well. I'm probably going to be butchering a lot of names, but I'm not sure what he does except for dying.
Die. He's the god of dying by mistletoe. It's really sad. Why are we laughing? It's really sad.
Yeah, it just, yeah, death by mistletoe, Ragnarok. There you go.
I have a very distinct memory of reading that myth for the first time and genuinely being really sad when I was a kid.
Sorry, what's the mistletoe thing?
Oh, yeah. So was mistletoe like the one thing that could kill Balder?
Well, because it's essentially like almost like an Achilles heel.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that thing. So, myths are the same. Yeah.
His mother made sure.
Are we going to mark our bingo cards for Achilles being close to Romans? Is that how Simone has got the Romans in by mentioning Achilles? Is that how
he's it? It's not quite anywhere near.
Even close, man.
So does he like eat the mistletoe, or does he?
No, Loki makes into a dart.
Ah, okay.
But then has someone else fire it at it? But then he could have survived, I think, like if all the creatures of the earth wept for Balder. But one didn't, I think a Jotun, but then it turns out that was actually Loki in disguise.
Just the worst, man. But I appreciate that. I don't know. That's always tracked with me, you know. Not to be like, oh, I liked Loki before he was popular, but like, I always really liked Loki stories because I was like, I'm also that annoying all the time. I see myself in him.
I think going through like all of the stories about all the tricks and heists he pulls, it's just oh boy.
He's messy, and I love that about him.
Yes, but since I mentioned Jotun, because of course we've briefly mentioned sort of the Norse pantheon, but of course within you have several different, I don't know whether it's populations, groups that I guess can all in a way sort of be classed as god, depending on how you define a god. But within, I guess, the Norse pantheon and various like sort of inhabitants of the world, you have the ones that were the most popular gods, if you will, are the Aesir. So that'll be Odin, I guess, this is part giant, but yeah, well, Aesir. too long to get into it. But, you know, like Thor and Balder, like they're part of the Aesir who reside in Asgard. Then you have the Jotun, which the Aesir are constantly at war with, which are the giants, although they're not all necessarily giants. And Loki is indeed, I think, at least part Jotun, if I remember correctly.
It's one of those things, I think, that, you know, we were already just talking about how a lot of the written texts on these myths are from way later on, and they're always based in oral traditions. So the problem with oral traditions is, of course, you will have that fluctuation in, you know, like this myth, Loki is part Jotun, and then like in this myth, he's not. There's loads of things like that. And it's funny when you like read academic texts on these things, you have to kind of just be like, well, if you read it based on so-and-so, it says this. But if you look up this version, it's completely different.
Well, I think like Freya, she's part of the Vanir, which is again another sort of popular, another group all together, which sort of more magic wielding, if you will, to simplify it, who are also at war with the Aesir. The Aesir are just at war with everyone. But there was a truce, which I believe is why Freya is in Asgard in the first place, because she was like a hostage, her and her brother, that was sort of sent to the Aesir, yeah. And I guess then just fit right in by the end of it.
It's all about messiness. And if you've read the sagas as well, the sagas are so messy. So many of the sagas are just basically family disputes and just like two families fighting, and that's like the entire saga. And I love that. It's just, it's great. It also seems to reflect on what my family life was like for the Norwegian part of it. So I guess that's just something that happens culturally.
But it's like, no, the beauty of it, like, is some of them sagas, it's like, it's not just like the family's warring, which I guess in itself is not, it's not that funny, but it's just this ability to hold grudges for hundreds of years. So you get to the seventh generation down and you're still holding a grudge because your neighbor's great, 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 great grandfather looked at your goat funny.
You know, none of my family listens to this podcast. So like, that's something I definitely have developed because of my family, like the ability to hold a grudge. It's something I grew up watching when my family would fight with each other. And I also harbor that skill. So it's just nice to see yourself reflected in media for once, you know? Anyway, just going past messiness, just to kind of wrap up this little overview. So the cosmology of the Norse mythology is, there's Yggdrasil, which is a tree, a big tree, and it's technically broken up into about nine realms. Gods mostly live in Asgard, as we were kind of talking about with Marvel, and us humans live in Midgard. You have Jotunheim, which is for the giants.
You'd guess.
And then Helheim, which is one L, but it's essentially hell, except it's cold and frozen, which is like my kind of underworld view anyway.
You're kind of hell. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yeah. I don't want to say bad words on this show.
Oh, sorry. We can say it's your kind of Helheim.
It's heck. Heckheim.
Oh, you're... Yeah, editor, please censor that H-E-L-L word. That's too... Our audience ears are too pure.
Is that a bad word?
I think it... Growing up, it was seen as a bad word.
Yeah, when I was in like primary school, one of my teachers thought it was a really, really bad word. So she wouldn't actually even say the phrase hell or high water. She said or high water. And I thought that was the funniest thing ever because it was in a book in the school. But yeah, some people think it's a bad word because, yeah, I don't know.
I guess it's also might be one of those things where I guess it's worse in the US than in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I think in the US we're a bit more stodgy with the curse words, I think.
Because I think Britain swears a lot more liberally.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, where I grew up is basically the south of the UK. Not geographically, but like in relation to America. I can, like, Northern Ireland's pretty tough like that.
Yeah. Anyway, real quick before we go to break, I feel like we should need to talk about Ragnarok real fast. We already kind of mentioned it, but since we're talking about cusses and stuff, Ragnarok is where everyone will be cussing because it's the end of the world, because the gods will fight their enemies. It culminates the end of the world, which is extremely bleak, but hey, it kind of ends with the promise of a world reborn, which is always kind of nice. And as we go through this episode, I think you'll really be able to see the impact that Norse mythology has on a lot of European fantasy, especially when you look at the wider world of beings, because Norse mythology includes elves, dwarves, giants, trolls, loads of other creatures. And I think we'll start talking about those after the break. And we are back with Archaeo Animals. We are talking about the zooarchaeology of myths and legends, more specifically Norse mythology. And I think to start off our actual talking about the zooarchaeology of these things, we might as well talk about Loki. Loki has a very little, weird little family. And there's a lot to talk about here. So Loki is a shapeshifter. a weirdly large amount of other characters in Norse mythology. I kind of forgot until we started doing research for this. I was like, oh yeah, like almost everyone can shapeshift in Norse mythology.
Yeah, like so some can turn into eagles, some can turn into eagles and more.
Yeah, but for the most part, I feel like they mostly just kind of turn into other people. Like Loki seems to do that a lot. Loki has turned into many animals, though, including a fly, a salmon, a mare. And there's one myth, I forget which myth it is, but there's a myth where he turns into an old woman who I believe his name is Tak, which is the word for thank you.
Yes.
I don't know why. I can't remember why he does
is
that.
Is it the one during one of the tests? I think it was for, it was a test for Thor, I believe. Well, like one of the tests for something was to beat this woman in combat.
So oh,
he would
yeah.
beat old age, but he didn't.
I think I might have been. There's a lot of that happening. That myth that you're talking about, that Thor has to go around in, is basically similar to kind of like the 12 labors of Heracles, in terms of Thor having to go around and do a bunch of stuff. But like all of it is little trickery. So it's like, oh, you have to pick up this cat, Thor. And he tries to pick it up. And it turns out it's Jormungandr, who is the giant serpent we'll be talking about in a little bit. They just do that a lot. They're like, let's turn this one thing into something else, which again, I feel like tracks.
the one with the fly, I believe it was in Loki, was in Jotunheim.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that didn't go down too well because I think he was nearly squished several times. I think they did find him out in the end.
It's Loki's a mess, which again, I just love to see myself represented finally in media as someone who's also a shapeshifter who just screws up all the time, constantly. Although I haven't done some of these things, which is have very eclectic family and a very eclectic group of children. So I mean, we should start off with Sleipnir. I always forget how to say this one.
Oh, you tell me. But yes, that is a child of Loki. Well, back on the time, you know, we just mentioned when Loki was in mare form.
So it's not that weird, right?
No, which I believe was something to do to keep... Was it a giant's horse busy?
Yeah.
He was building something in Asgard, but I think if he finished at a certain time... Did marry Freya or something like that?
Svafilfari is the other horse and is the other parent of Sleipnir, who was like a big horse who was trying to like build a bunch of buildings, I believe. Is that the one you're talking about?
I believe that is the myth, because it wasn't quite on a bet, if I remember correctly, but it was just something that if you got everything done in time, there would be a high price to be paid by the Aesir. So, of course, they were trying to make sure he didn't finish in time because I think the horse was doing a lot of the helping him with the labor. Loki found a new creative way to keep said horse, Svafilfari, occupied.
Yeah.
And occupied, he did keep him. And Sleipnir was born.
And Sleipnir is considered the best of all horses, probably because... this guy eight legs, folks. He is a horse spider in some ways. Is that an upsetting image? Probably. And you know what? I do apologize for that. But don't know how else to really describe it.
I mean, in terms of like zoologically speaking, so how would that work? Because then would he... okay, he's got the eight legs, but would he have eight scapulars as well? Well, no, maybe not eight scapulars. So he's got four front legs and four back legs. Would he have four shoulder joints at the front?
Yeah, I was trying to figure this out because I was like, okay, like if it does have eight legs and it is kind of like a spider, but then the spider's body is shaped completely different in a way that it can, and like obviously the legs work in a way that it could all fit. And obviously spiders also don't have skeletons. So this is kind of not really a good comparison.
What about for the four back legs? What about the pelvis?
Yeah.
Would they have like an abnormally large pelvis with like four different acetabulums?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, most depictions of Sleipnir, especially more modern depictions where people are really trying to make it quote-unquote realistic, they do tend to do that, where there are four legs, and then four back legs. But even then, like, if you look at images, you know, a lot of times they'll have Sleipnir in motion. And it's like, how does that even work? Like, if it's trotting, do you know what I mean?
Because in some depictions as well, they look sort of almost like soft, the limbs. It's almost like an octopus tentacles are going, woo.
Maybe it's like, yeah, maybe they're like non-functioning limbs. Like,
yeah, like vestigial limbs or something. So they actually got the four. And the extra ones, I don't know, maybe for balance. So it could run at very fast pace and still remain sort of fairly stable.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that Sleipnir is considered the best of all horses to the point that Odin was like, oh, that's mine now.
Dibs.
So, yeah, dibs, as Odin is wont to do. And so we have to assume then that the eight legs adds to, you know, the speed and the strength of the horse. But I don't know how, like, even if you elongate the torso enough that there's ample room for every leg, it has to have like either multiple pelvis and scapulae or just bigger pelvis and scapulae to like kind of, you know.
I mean, I guess he would have been a very large horse. I mean, this fictional horse would have been a very large horse in size, because I mean, if Svadilfari, the father, was a Jotun's horse, it would have been no pony. Put it that way. So I guess it'd be a very large horse to begin with. So I guess, yeah, if they had some extra sort of, even if vestigial limbs. Yes, I guess we ruled that the four acetabulums on the pelvis could potentially work, possibly. I'm not sure about the four scapulars, but I guess if they're non-working, if it's just fully fused to the thoracic vertebrae, just the extra two limbs, and they're not actually being used, that could work that way.
Obviously, it happens in nature that some animals are born with, you know, vestigial limbs, and that's kind of how it works. They're not necessarily working limbs. They're usually kind of just grown in a way that it can't be used and doesn't need to be used. So I kind of assume that must be how it works with Sleipnir, but I don't know. It's wild.
Just it's interesting how it contributes to it being the best of horses. Unless he was the best of horses for other reasons, then his...
Could be very pretty.
Yeah.
Nice. Could be very nice.
Pretty nice horse. Maybe, you don't know, he spoke 10 languages fluently. We don't know.
Odin liked poetry, so maybe he was really good at poetry.
I mean, nothing to do with Odin claiming it because he was like the equivalent of a child. No, nothing like that.
Although, I mean, I do want to point out, though, like, archaeologically, we do have archaeological, not proof, but, you know, it'll be the case for a lot of these kind of mythical creatures. They show up on a lot of rune stones, picture stones, image stones. I don't know why we have different words for all these stones. Again, I don't work in Viking archaeology anymore. But yeah, we do have at least two possible instances found on 8th century picture stones from Gotland, including the Ardra the third image stone and the Yangvild image stone. So we know Sleipnir existed in the hearts and minds of the Norse.
Yes.
You're still just thinking about how those legs work, huh?
I'm just like, I'm gonna lie awake tonight and be like, how would that pelvis work? It's just too many acetabuli. I guess that'll be the plural.
Yeah, no.
If you've not heard of it, for those who have not heard of it, the acetabulum is literally the hip socket where the femur slots in. That's the acetabulum.
Just people being like, we've never had a pluralizer like that.
The acetabula. But yes, moving on to Loki's children. There's another very, very wee little child.
Just a tiny,
mostly harmless. Again, very well known, I'm sure. Plenty of reference to popular culture. There's Jormungandr, the world serpent. Just basically a giant sea serpent that encircles the world and grasps its own tail, which Loki has had with the giantess Angrboda.
Yeah, and the importance of Jormungandr is that when it releases its tail, finally, Ragnarok will officially begin. And it is basically a living Ouroboros, which I was kind of thinking about. I was like, oh, so when Jormungandr grows, does the tail grow further into its mouth / body?
That's a disturbing thought.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it is very disturbing because, to be fair, we haven't really discussed, like, serpentine, snake, osteology on this show. And one, it's because we don't really run into it that much, both of us, like, professionally. And two, snake skulls are scary. And I love snakes. Like, I've always wanted a pet snake. Snake skulls are scary. Don't Google them.
Yeah, I wonder, like, instead of growing in length, maybe it grows in width?
Just like a big, thick snake.
Or what it does is it lets go as it grows of the tail, and it only has a certain bit in its mouth.
Well, because I guess then at Ragnarok, he lets go of it altogether.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's got the control. He's got the control.
Well, I mean, he can let go occasionally, because there's that great myth where Thor is just, like, on a fishing trip and, like, just catches Jormungandr. And they're like, Thor, put him back, please.
Hey, be careful, you might accidentally start Ragnarok.
But it's really funny because, like, that's the most, from what I've seen, one of the most popular depictions of Jormungandr is that scene of Thor picking him up from during a fishing trip, which I love because that's ridiculous.
Also, I guess that was kind of his nemesis.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's
the final showdown in Ragnarok is Thor and Jormungandr.
Yeah, but also he got caught during a fishing trip. Like, come on.
Well, he picked him up when he thought it was a cat.
That's true, yeah. You know what? I kind of get why Jormungandr doesn't like Thor. Like, I get it. Like, my dude just wants to chill eating his own tail, and this guy just keeps picking him up.
I mean, valid.
Jormungandr, you're valid.
It actually just Ouroboros reminds me of that really good song by Gojira every time. You know the intro to it. Simone, you'll know this. Like the dilla 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 dum 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 go. Sorry. It's in my head. I know exactly where it is. Simone, I hope you recognize that.
I appreciate the reference.
I don't know what anyone's talking about.
Welcome to RQ Animals, where our producer does covers of black metal bands.
Well, do you know what I think is kind of funny? Because, like, you know, it's always one of us who's kind of out of the loop, you know?
That's true.
It's always one, you know? There's only ever two, you know, in on the joke.
That's how we maintain balance. It's a dyad.
Oh, sorry, death metal, not black metal, before all the purists out there, like...
It's okay.
Hurt me. Please don't hurt me. I don't do music. I have select music that I like and I listen to it. That's where my knowledge ends.
Please don't hurt Simona. She's already hurt by the idea of a horse with eight legs. Well, we can at least talk about one normal child to wrap up this segment.
I mean, ish. Yeah.
Let's be real. Okay, out of all of them, the most normal child, Fenrir. Of course, who is also a child of Loki and Angerbotha, and he's just a big wolf.
But how does it work? So you have, like, Loki is potentially part Jotun and definitely humanoid in looks.
Yeah.
Angerbotha, Jotun.
Yes.
Also in a way humanoid,
yes,
in looks. So giant snake, giant wolf. How?
Are you telling me that you don't know Jotun genealogy? Do I need to explain it to you? It's very simple.
You go ahead.
Yeah.
There are two wolves inside you.
Oh, no.
And one of the wolves is a big serpent, so, you know.
And the other one is a fox with anxiety.
What does it say?
No.
No.
I'm hitting the side of the park. Sorry. I interrupted the show yet again.
Tristan made that joke and was pointing at the backstands like he was Babe Ruth about to hit a home run, and no one was having it.
Okay, I'll go back to my corner now.
Yes. Anyway, Fenrir is technically the most normal child because he is just a big wolf. And I don't even think he's that much bigger than wolves. I think he's just kind of a wolf, right?
Yeah, he has grown, like, very big very quickly. But I think it depends. Maybe he may have looked bigger in Odin's head, given that he was terrified of the poor wolfie, to the point at which the poor Fenrir ended up with trust issues, and again, valid, getting validation thousands of years later, because thanks to, long story, but thanks to, I guess, Odin being his pranker trickster self, Fenrir ends up biting the hand of Tyr.
Yeah, because they're like, oh, hey, Tyr, if you want to prove your loyalty, you'll put your hand in on this wolf, which is really funny. Just like... You got yeah, because they were like binding Fenrir, I believe, and then all this other drama was happening. Next thing you know,
yeah, mostly just Odin being terrified because I think he had been prophesied that Fenrir was going to kill him, so he's just basically off on one. He just had it in for poor Fenrir, basically.
Yeah, he's basically a wolf, which is I'm trying to think. Like, I don't know if wolves. Because obviously wolves show up a lot in Norse mythology, but I feel like they don't show up as much as you'd think. It's all about the serpents, really. I feel like there's a lot of serpents in Norse mythology for some reason.
Are there even that many serpents? Are they called snakes in Scandinavia?
No, well, that's the weird thing, is that it seems like serpent and dragon were kind of used interchangeably. Like, Jormungandr is definitely like a sea serpent. But there are myths, and we'll talk about one in the next part, where... It seems to be interchangeable, and whether or not the idea of a serpent kind of became more of a dragon type later on, I don't know. But yeah, I don't really think there's really snakes in Scandinavia.
I guess when you think about it, a big snake is essentially a flightless dragon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a deep thought, Simona, and I think we should think about it as we go into our break. And we'll be back, not talking about Loki's kids. We'll talk about some other ones.
Promise.
Yeah. And we are back with Archaeo Animals. We are talking about the zoo archaeology of myths and legends, more specifically Norse mythology. And we're going to move on from Loki's extremely eclectic family and kind of talk about some other creatures and beings in Norse mythology, which, to be fair, was doing this research, I realized there really isn't any like specific ones. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I guess it's not much a variety of animals per se. Some of them will cover, I guess, people in a way. So like different populations or different groups, because then the animals mostly don't look that much different. Of course, you have things, I don't know, like that maybe are different or have more powers, but then don't necessarily look morphologically any different. So like, look at Thor's goats, which regenerate.
Yeah, I think there's less to do with there's less like largely mythical creatures or hybrid creatures that you'll see in other mythologies and other places. It's very much either, like you said, like it's like normal kind of animals that are slightly different in some ways, whether they're regenerating like Thor's goats or they're just extremely big. And I think it's also the case of so many of these figures in Norse mythology who can shapeshift. So it's like, oh, they can just turn into something else. So, which is kind of the case of our next example, which is Fafnir, who was a dwarf. And the thing about dwarves in Norse mythology is they are kind of what we imagine dwarves to be in fantasy. But the same thing with giants, I think, as well, where it's unclear as to whether or not they were always kind of what we traditionally think of as giants or dwarves nowadays, or if that's changed over time, especially in retellings.
Yeah, because the one thing that stays the same is they weren't always depicted in the best of lights.
Nah.
They weren't given a very fair treatment in the sagas. Well, Fafnir is one such example, because he was so greedy that he literally turned into a dragon.
Or, again, in some instances, a serpent. But I think dragon is kind of what is agreed upon, because he wanted to protect his gold. And this is probably, like we were just talking about Tolkien, this was probably the inspiration for Smaug from The Hobbit. And archaeologically, you actually see Fafnir as the dragon in a lot of artwork, including panels. So the Scandinavian panel art is very popular in churches. There's one at the Heidelstad Stave Church as well, because dragons and serpents make wonderful swirly little patterns. And that's like all that kind of artwork.
In a way, it's very interesting that this, even into sort of the Christian era, so the mythology has remained and has become part of the architecture of Christian buildings.
Yeah, that's something that you kind of notice in Viking Age archaeology. Like, even though everyone is Christianized, you still continue to see, it's almost like a folk art type thing where, you know, again, they're all Christianized, but they sneak a little, not even sneak. It might have been like considering it as like folklore. We don't necessarily believe in that on a religious scale, but, you know, it's, we still enjoy and love that in a more cultural approach, if that makes sense. So you see it in a lot of artwork still, even as we enter that kind of era.
Yeah, and again, like it gets weirder because Fafnir does eventually get slayed by the Germanic hero Sigurd, who consumes his heart and blood, and that gives him the ability to talk to birds.
Yeah, so this is another weird thing that I think happens a lot in Norse mythology, people eating other people's hearts and drinking their blood. And then, you know, you occasionally will get the ability to talk to birds. There's, I can't remember who it is. There's a myth where I think it's two dwarves make wine out of someone else's blood, and that gives them the ability to do poetry. I'm really blanking on like the actual names of the figures, but it's a very popular trope in Norse mythology, is this idea of consuming the remains of someone else and gaining those abilities.
Just like very pointless superpowers. Like, what do you do? I talk to birds.
I mean, you know, Odin talks to birds. You making fun of Odin now? Harsh. Sure. Harsh. My man likes talking to birds and poetry. He's a gentle-hearted soul. Speaking of hearts, though, while I was researching this, I was like, I wonder if that might be a fun place to talk about hearts and how obviously we don't really find hearts in archaeology. But I was like, there has to be a case of someone finding, because obviously preservation methods and environmental factors, we have found weirder things that have been preserved through time. And yeah, turns out in 2016, they found a fossilized heart of a prehistoric fish. Boo, but still kind of cool. Ooh. So I'm not even going to try pronounce the scientific name of that fish. I have it written down.
Racolepis buccalis.
Roman general.
No, you can be a lieutenant. Racolepis buccalis.
Really building an army here, huh?
Yeah, is it like this? Yeah, the archaeoanimals.
There you go. We also officially got Romans in. Check that off your bingo card, folks. We did it.
You did it, not me.
Yeah, well, I try to help the cause when I can.
Huh. Just gentle nudges here and there.
Yeah. It's interesting that they were able to find that. That's an extremely amazing find. But, I mean, hearts are delicate things. It's very rare to really see that survive. I can't think of anything else. I'm sure there's other instances of hearts surviving. I can't think off the top of my head. From bog bodies, maybe?
I mean, likely. I mean, I think they've had some preserved in Egyptian mummies, where I can't remember which one specifically. Mm-hmm. But I think they managed to work out that, I can't remember if it was a heart attack or something, that what the actual cause of death was.
Oh, that's cool.
But please do not quote me on that in every way, shape or form. Because I don't remember specifically.
I know the finding of this fossilized heart was a big deal. I mean, obviously, because it's a fossilized heart, but also it's one of those rare abilities where they're able to look at the cardiovascular system, or at least part of it, of a long extinct animal, which is extremely cool.
Because how prehistoric are we talking? Because it's fossilized, so talking at least Pleistocene.
Yeah, I think it was Pleistocene. I cannot remember. I mean, even still, like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But if we find more fossilized hearts, who knows? Maybe you can bite into it and learn how to speak to birds.
Well, going on from your trend of wanting to eat everything.
Yeah, that's true. Moving on. I know we were like, oh, we won't talk about video games in this episode, although we already have, but we'll do it a bit more because it's our podcast. We don't care. Because we are going to talk about Draugr.
Yeah, because Skyrim wasn't too far off, was it?
No, it's pretty accurate, to be honest. I feel like you can't really do much with the concept in terms of like going too different. Like in Skyrim, they are undead beings, but they are interestingly very different in style when we compare them to Skyrim's kind of undead. So if you've not played Skyrim, first of all, congratulations. I don't know how you've avoided it this whole time, especially since it's been coming out in special editions for the past 10 years. But the undead of Skyrim are almost like mummified, that kind of preserved body.
I think they are in most of the depictions in popular culture, Skyrim and other video games. Cause I'm pretty sure the ones in God of War are also not quite mummified, but just strangely preserved corpses with strange armor and red eyes and just...
Yeah, because the one in Skyrim I'm thinking of, they for me, they seem very mummified. The way that their skin is still attached, it's very tight. They're very, like, almost muscular still, which I find really interesting. But traditionally in Norse mythology, they're actually mostly described as bloated corpses. So they're usually blue or black in color. They have very swollen bodies. And I think that's actually really interesting to think about because it's kind of like they're showing two different bodies under different taphonomic circumstances.
And also in a way, like, much more terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Like, I think the idea of, like, a bloated corpse coming at me is way more terrifying. And also, like, so clearly based on reality. You know what I mean? Like, people had seen so many corpses that way that it became mythology. Like, that's exactly what the Draugr were.
Because there is one story in mythology, I can't remember who, like, more the hero is, more of an anti-hero kind of figure. I think it takes place around Christmas because the farm, he gets to stay in this farm because it's haunted by this Draugr that he eventually manages to kill. But I think just the look or like of that creature's face will go on haunting him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, it's interesting, obviously, to see that kind of myth-making of the corpse being something to fear. And it's very, like, realistic, the idea, the way Draugr are depicted. And it's also kind of interesting to think about how we depict the undead in modern times and how that's always kind of changed. I mean, you think of OG zombies and things like Night of Living Dead versus you watch Walking Dead where they try to be as realistic as possible to the idea of a corpse. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not, yeah.
But no, sorry, I just looked it up. So like the saga that I was mentioning sort of with the Draugr on Christmas Eve. The Draugr is called Glamr.
Oh,
and here is the Grettis saga.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that now.
Yeah, because then he kind of like at the end of it, so the Draugr just stares at him and prophesizes something, and then just like make him just spiral basically for the rest of his life. So it's quite traumatic, which again, valid. Oh, lots of validation thousands of years from now coming from me.
But yeah, I mean, that's like one of the things I always really liked about Norse mythology and a lot of other mythologies is how not realistic, but how human they are. Because I've always enjoyed a mythology where the gods and the heroes are as infallible as humans. And I think that's kind of like the draw for a lot of people. It's a very popular thing in Norse mythology, like you were just saying, the idea of going kind of like in distress because of hearing a prophecy. As someone who also has an anxiety disorder, you know, I'm also worrying about the future all the time. So again, I feel seen with mythology.
Especially if you get like a bleak future prophesized by a black, blue, bloated corpse staring right at you. I mean,
but yeah, I mean, that won't help aesthetically. I will say, though, Draugr in Norse mythology, kind of cooler than Draugr in Skyrim. One, I don't run into Draugr all the time like I do in Skyrim. And two, Draugr in Norse mythology had loads of other powers. Sometimes they were kind of described more as what would be closer to what we consider vampires. They could do magic. They could shapeshift. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, because also, in a way, like, I don't remember what the rationale was for the ones in Skyrim, but I think in Norse mythology, like, they rise, like, under sort of fairly specific circumstances.
Yeah.
Kind of if it's a violent death or just something that turns you into a Draugr, not just, you know, you walk into a dungeon and then just, boom, they're crawling all over the place.
A Draugr, I believe a lot of times you become one because of something bad that's happened, particularly like in your actual life.
Yeah, because I think like the one saga that I mentioned specifically, the Draugr sort of, the pre-Draugr times, he wasn't a very nice man to begin with, kind of thing.
What's really interesting as well is I think some of the origins of the Draugr myth comes from, which is something you can see in other cultures when it comes to things like zombies or vampires, comes from people finding corpses. Because one of the indications of a person becoming a Draugr was that if they saw the corpse wasn't in its proper horizontal position. It was in a different, like a sitting position. Which, of course, obviously, you know, corpses do lots of things once they're dead. A lot of mechanisms occurring internally. And unlike what many people may think, the body will not always just kind of lay there. There are a lot of other things occurring. So it seems like some of the origin of this myth as well is people finding a corpse who may have been going through rigor mortis or was disturbed in some other way and just immediately being like, oh, that's a... they're coming back, baby.
Yeah, because I think one common thing is that as the skin sort of in your nails retreat, it looks like your nails have grown.
Yeah, that as well. That's a big...
And that does tend to like scare people. I mean, it could be distressing just like whether it looks like the nails have grown or not. It's just a distressing experience, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course. It's very easy to see where... I mean, even, you know, in modern times, we have those myths. I mean, well, like you were just saying... It's a very common misconception of people saying, oh, your hair and your nails grow after death, which obviously it doesn't. It's your skin kind of shrinking back.
Everything else shrinks. But it's you find that out 1,000 years ago. And you're,
Yeah, fair play. I get it for sure. And even still today, obviously, people, if you see rigor mortis happening, it is very scary if you're not familiar with it. So it totally understand how that becomes its own myth. Anyway, we've talked a lot about dead things for an archaeology podcast. So,
well, an archaeology podcast that does talk about dead things.
Yes, yes, yes.
Animals mainly, but yes.
I feel like we would be amiss if we didn't end the podcast at least talking about the Jotun. Because I feel like that's the other thing people seem to at least get through osmosis about Norse mythology is obviously Thor, whatever. But also, oh, there's like giants in there, right?
Yes, who produce interesting children.
Yeah, and the funny thing, and we kind of talked about this earlier, maybe not necessarily what we consider giants today. The thing I've kind of noticed is that, if anything, they're just extremely exaggerated beings. So if they're big, they'll be very big. If they're short, they're very short. They are very ugly. They're very beautiful, all those kinds of things. So they're always at the extremes, but they aren't necessarily what we would consider giants today.
Yeah, I guess that's just like one catch-all term to just describe the people the Aesir don't like.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as a short person, I also consider all tall people my enemy, so I get it.
So tall people, fish, squirrels.
Yeah. The list gets bigger every day.
And you know how to hold a grudge, so.
Yes, thank you to my Norwegian ancestors. You've trained me so well. And I feel so seen doing this episode. But the Jotun, I think, are interesting, and giants are interesting because, you know, a lot of times, especially in Norse mythology, giants are often described when they're talking about big giants. They'll describe them as like, oh, we thought it was a mountain. It turns out it was a giant and things like that. And I think it's interesting to think about archaeologically how a lot of times those myths probably came from just finding like, oh, that mountain looks like a dude. You know, that's how I would do it, at least.
Yeah, like with those sizes, it kind of in a way sort of reminds me of the Titans in Greek mythology.
Ooh, somewhere. I wonder if we'll talk something about that next week. Who knows? You'll have to tune in.
Next week.
You know what I mean? Next episode. It's fine. I'm fine. Just done a lot of soul searching with this episode. Again, feeling seen. But you know what? That's Norse mythology, baby. And I guess we're at the end of our episode. So as always, like and subscribe and review our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about this weird show you listen to where they really don't talk about archaeology, but they do sometimes. We're fun. I don't know. You can follow us on Facebook. We're at ArchaeoAnimals. We are also at ArchaeoAnimals on Twitter. Again, if you want us to cover some more mythology type of zoo archaeology things, let us know. We love doing the research. I like doing the research, at least. We have another episode coming up with a different type of mythology, but you'll see that soon. Anything else?
Just the Norse mythology, you are valid. Just validating everything this evening, it seems.
If you learn anything from Norse mythology, just remember, you're valid. See you next time, folks.
Thank you for listening to ArchaeoAnimals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Laura Johnson.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.